Welcome to In Conversation from the Royal Australian Air Force. On March the 8th, 2014, a Boeing 777 with 239 people on board departed Kuala Lumpur, headed for Beijing. It never arrived. Following final communication with the aircraft 38 minutes into its flight, it disappeared from air traffic control's radar, having changed course. In the coming days, satellite analysis suggested Malaysian flight MH370 was likely to have come down somewhere in the southern Indian Ocean off the coast of Western Australia. What was to become one of the world's largest maritime search operations started with Air Force AP3C Orions under the guidance of the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, whilst a multinational group gathered at RAAF Base Pierce outside Perth to help with the search. In this episode, we'll hear from the Air Force pilot flying 300 feet above the ocean looking for clues, a public affairs officer just 3 days into her Air Force career with the world's media camped on her doorstep. But first, Air Commodore Andrew Craig Heap, the commander for the multinational task group, with a very unique insight into the search for MH370.
What we were searching for initially was not where the airliner went in to the water. We're actually looking for where the remains of the aircraft, possibly any survivors, were floating to. And we're now playing with, by the time I got there, almost 2 weeks' time late on when the aircraft went in the water.
Talk through, if you would, that kind of search area. Those figures are mind-blowing, aren't they, really, the sort of scale of things?
If you understand the distances and the challenges there, yes. So I suppose the best analogy I could make is that if you understand how big Australia is, and people don't quite get that either sometimes, but if you are flying all these missions out of, let's say, Richmond or East Sale, the RAF bases at Richmond or East Sale, then what we are doing is doing a visual search of an area the size of Western Australia, our largest state. The reality was what we're looking for, but is something the size of a car, that it's mixed in with. It's a white car mixed in with white caps, and it's probably only a car door, not so much the car, that we're going to be looking for, and that area is the size of Western Australia.
How confident were you if there was things to be found that you could?
I was relatively confident if we got in and on top and close and the debris itself was large enough that we'd be able to call it. But on some of the days, for people that understand maritime flying and maritime searches, as soon as the wind gets above 15, 20 knots, you generate significant white caps. And that's pretty much 50% of the time out in the Indian Ocean in certain areas. There were some very still areas where there wasn't any white caps, where we have a much higher chance of seeing something if we fly right close to it. But then there was other times where there was, you know, significant thunderstorms in the area. And on the day in those search areas, if the debris was underneath those thunderstorms, then we obviously didn't fly under it because we wouldn't have been able to see anything anyway outside of the danger of flying under a thunderstorm at low level.
So what did the international community, the international air forces, bring to the search that maybe helped and assisted?
They brought an ability in daylight hours to conduct a concentrated search of the areas that AMSA wanted to look at, a search of the surface, looking for debris of any description or any other sign of MH370. Without their contribution, at best we would have probably only had up to about 5 Australian P3s, which would have not covered the same area. We would have only covered sort of a third of Western Australia, not the remaining two-thirds.
Can I touch on the expectation, not only from yourself and colleagues of trying to find debris, but also external expectation, the public, the press, VIPs? The gaze was really on you all at that time.
Yes, there was a significant amount of, I suppose, there's massive strategic interest, obviously, because of all the nations involved. But I think the reality was we were all either trying to find the people for the family and friends, the missing people, the missing passengers and crew of MH370, for the family and friends of those people. We're also very appreciative and understood that the media, while they're pretty aggressive, they're also really, there's tremendous interest in this, as we just lost an airliner, an international airliner that doesn't happen very often, and it had not been found. And it was there's lots of questions to be asked about that. So there was a lot of strategic imperatives, including the one about, you know, the safety of international aviation, really, and that type of aircraft, the 777, which is a very safe aircraft with a great safety record. You know, how all that played out.
Were you surprised at that level of interest, though, the international level of interest?
Not really, But once you're actually in the pack of media, as I don't think too many people, even at the prime ministerial level, as I got to talk to a number of prime ministers in the space and senior people as well that were interviewed, really, if ever, had they seen the same sort of, I suppose I'll call it a media pack, that level of international interest, whenever there were the early, especially the first 3 weeks when there was early media interviews conducted both with the senior VIPs that came through, be they the acting prime minister or the prime minister or other senior officers or me, or it moved over into Sir Angus Houston as the head of the Joint Agency Coordination Centre after a while. But there was tremendous interest, and we understood that that was all part of what we're doing, is this had a tremendous international interest for a whole bunch of different reasons.
You took the view of being inclusive with international media, for domestic media, and you drew them in, and that was a deliberate act.
It was deliberate. It was deliberate to treat the media as an opportunity, not a threat. And in this case, what we did was a number of different tranches. The first one was to be open as best we could. But the last thing we wanted to do was also, I suppose, for want of a better term, give false hope to those family and friends of those people at all, but be very honest, absolutely honest at all stages for what we saw, what we found, what we were doing.
Every sortie, you must have felt you're going to come back with something positive, and then there wasn't. But there had to be day two, day three, and so on.
There was always a tremendous hope and an optimism that we would get lucky, that we would be able to find the needle in the haystack, because we had a very good team from across all those nations, the best, again, that the Pacific could certainly produce, with some of the best aircraft. When the conditions were good, we had a red-hot chance of finding that debris if we got in the right place at the right time and everything was there. But it's like, it's very... It was all. There's so many different factors in there that have led us to not being able to find one of those pieces of debris.
Can I just touch on the expectation politically? Almost everybody of any significance visited your doorstep at some point.
Yes, there were a lot of visits, and again, opportunity, not threat. This was a great opportunity to directly brief people in, you know, all the way to the Prime Minister of Australia, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and other dignitaries from different nations. The chief of the Malaysian Air Force also was there as well. But it's a great opportunity for them to come, to be briefed by us in the heart of the search as to what we're doing. From my perspective, the great job we were doing, but also the challenges that we were facing. And then to give them an appreciation so they can go back and talk to their people and say, hey, we are collectively doing the best we can do as far as trying to find MH370 for those family and the friends of the people on the aircraft.
Were they pleased with the effort the search was going on?
I think they all were. They saw their own nation's contribution being appropriately utilised and appreciated, and also we were all dedicated to the one aim.
There was a very clear window for potential in the sense of a transponder that had a battery life of 40 days?
Yes, yeah, so the type of, I suppose, transducer, it's called, which is on the flight data recorder. There's two black boxes, a flight data recorder and a cockpit voice recorder in most airliners and some military aircraft. So they're the two things we were searching for. They had a transducer that transmitted at 37.5 kilohertz, a signal underwater when it got wet. So both these boxes would have been transmitting that signal, but the signal, you know, the difficulty was the depth of the Indian Ocean. Generally deeper than 4,000 metres. The other issue was that signal is not readily receivable with normal acoustic signature. So we utilised some kit that we got, and we managed to then demonstrate that we could find and recall that's transducer signal. And from there we then, because we only had a limited amount of kits, so we put one of them on each of the five Australian aircraft, and we went out and conducted a different sort of search, which was a search realistically for around the impact point, the predicted impact point, as opposed to the debris field, which was moving significantly at a rate depending on the wind and the currents in that space. We dropped something like 2,000 sonobuoys over a period of a number of days inside that 30-day window to search for the... to search for the transducers, and unfortunately, we didn't find anything. Some of that might be because of the extreme depth.
One of the most important things as a commander going into any task is not so much what you do when you arrive, but plan your exit. How difficult was it to withdraw from the search?
The ending of the search was something that was really decided with the heads of government. We were happy to keep going for as long as we believed there could be an outcome. But it was moving into the period where we're now about 9 weeks down track, and the debris field would have moved significantly. The significant challenges of trying to find the transducer, which is probably almost now ran out of its battery. So the battery was assessed as being 30 days, might have gone to about 40 or a little bit more if the battery was relatively new. But past 40 days, you really had minimal chance of getting a signal at all. In other words, the transducer would have stopped working. The heartening piece was that the search wasn't really ceased, just that the air task group part of the search was called off at that point, which I think was early May, late April. The surface search continued for a little bit longer, and then there were various other ventures that occurred to search the seabed, which I think sort of go on to this day to a certain extent with different ventures. And hopefully one day the airliner will be found.
Do you think it will?
I hope it would. I think it will at some stage in the future. I think it will.
As a leader, you've taken part in not only an international event, but something so significant that it actually is part of the fabric of history. Do you feel your role in that is, looking back 10 years, do you realise you were taking part in something so significant?
I think you do. You realise that you're in something big when there's 100 journalists from all over the world, and the Prime Minister keeps turning up, along with many other senior dignitaries, including the Prime Minister of Malaysia. You look at the tremendous concerns, the tremendous resources that were thrown at this search, which was the longest range maritime search, from what I understand, in sort of human history. Then you get a sort of an idea of the gravity of what we were doing. But by the same token, it's while it was disappointing not to have found anything that was confirmed as coming from the airliner at all, I'm still very convinced for all the people that participated in the search, and also for the family and friends of the people that were on that airliner, both the crew and the passengers, that we did the best we could as a bunch of professionals from around our region. We put away our historical issues and challenges. It was the first time I think a Chinese military aircraft had come to Australia, let alone participate in an operation. And so it's one of those things where it really demonstrated and gave me some heart as to what humans can do when we all get together in the one noble and sort of defined cause.
That was Air Commodore Andrew Craigheap, commander of the multinational group at RAAF Pearce. Coming up, just what it's like to deal with the world's press and 125 media requests every day for news on the missing flight. But first, my colleague Rob Hodgson caught up with Flight Lieutenant Russell Adams. He flies fast jets these days, but in 2014, he was a couple of months into his captaincy of a Royal Australian Air Force AP-3C Orion, the aircraft of choice for search and rescue operations and for maritime surveillance.
The projected path had taken it down off the coast of Western Australia, and that was the point where we started to think, could this be us? And then got a call from my flight commander saying, hey, you guys are off to Pearce tomorrow. You're leaving at about midday. So we had, about 18 hours notice to move. And I went from kind of watching it glued on TV to then, being a part of it. So it was, pretty surreal moment in time.
Just tell us about the aircraft, what it can do, its capabilities and, what it's designed for.
For this aircraft that was designed in the 50s, the sheer engineering and mechanical engineering that goes into making that aircraft was never surpassed before the age of computers and microchips. You've got four engines on it and multiple hydraulic systems, flight control systems. What it was designed for in the 50s was to maritime patrol. What made it amazing for that was its massive fuel capability. It could carry 60,000 pounds, so about 12 hours of fuel, roughly. And you've got an amazing camera on it. You've also got a really big crew, which is what was What made it such a versatile platform?
You've flown out to RAF Base Pierce out in WA. They've got a search area to target for the missing aircraft. Just tell us about the conditions out that way when you head west. Obviously, the Fremantle Doctor, you know about that when you're in Perth, but when you head into the roaring 40s and furious 50s, like the conditions in the air, flying the Orion, just what was that like?
Unfortunately, I guess for the search, in the time between where they think it went down to the time we got there, there'd been a big low pressure system come through. And what that means is we were the first search area we had. It was about 1,200 miles southwest of Perth. So that's about a 4-hour flight to get there in an Orion. We get down there and it is low cloud. So we're down, you know, maybe 300-400 meters above the water. And we are just below cloud from memory. And the swell was significant. It was enough that if there'd been debris there, it would have been quite hard to see. We had a Navy ship at the time. It was one of the fleet support vessels that was tracking on south, and they were definitely restricted in terms of the sea state down there. So we've got big waves, kind of, I think from memory, kind of 3 to 4 meters in swell height, and then low cloud, and then winds at the surface making it quite choppy. So we go down there, get below the cloud, and then don't find anything on the radar. So then we start basically a visual search, and that's flying the aircraft at 300 feet, so about 100 meters above the water, and you're just flying like a GPS guided pattern, basically up and down with intermittent legs that were no more than potentially a mile or so apart, and you're just doing a big zigzag pattern until you ran out of fuel. We only had about 90 minutes to 2 hours of fuel to search down there. But yeah, it was a long way from home and not great weather conditions the first day specifically.
And so that would be all eyes on the water at that point. Then when you're visually searching for it, you get as many people near windows as you can. Just tell us how you do that.
It's something which I think people, you know, about all the incredible systems, like you know, amazing radar, you've got electronic detection systems on the aircraft. But if you're out there looking for like survivors in the water or boats, like, and you know, life rafts that aren't, you know, significant on radar, the primary sensor you have is the eyeball at the time. So on the Orion, it had a really big flight deck. You'd have two pilots and a flight engineer, but you would also have seating areas and observation windows for two other people. So you've got five people up in the nose. You would then, just after that, behind that, you'd have the tactical coordinator and the navigator, and they had big bubble windows so they could look out the side and see really well. Coming back from that, you also had an overwing window, which you could still see out of, but the wing obstructed it. But then towards the back of the aircraft, you had two more observation stations there. So at any time, you'd have 6 to 7 sets of eyes out. Looking sideways while you're flying, you know, relatively low, pretty slow to try and, you know, visually see, but you have to take shifts in watching. You know, it's kind of, especially in a bit of cloud and bad weather when you're out there, looking at the water and it's just this massive grey expanse of ocean. You're trying to spot any bit of any sign of debris, you know, life raft or anything. It's quite draining. So I would, you know, as a captain and with the tactical coordinator, you try and make sure you could rotate the people through the observation windows as much as possible. Specifically the aft, left and right, port and starboard observation windows there, you'd be making sure that the people there were changing at a maximum of every half hour or so.
Our former Prime Minister Tony Abbott described it as close to nowhere as you can get, that region down there. Was that? Did you see anything down there at all? Any fishing trawlers? Was there any sort of boating activity, or was it just absolutely the surface of the moon?
Yeah, in the 8 flights that I did down there, which totaled 70 odd hours flying, so about would have been all up maybe 30 to 35 hours with my eyes out the window, we saw a fishing net once.
Right.
That was what we saw down there. So it's a big ocean. The only ships that were in the area were the Navy ships that were coming down to help out. And there was there's no diver airfields. If anything goes wrong on your aircraft, you're limping home, you're the 1,000-odd miles back. So from an aviation perspective, there's literally no other aircraft, even today, there's no other aircraft in the world that I'd want to be on in that part of the world you've got four engines with all that redundancy. If anything goes wrong, you know, a lot of faith that the Orion would be able to make it back where it needs to go, a lot of fuel.
I guess you and your crew went into it with perfect situation. You would have found something. But I guess as the days progressed, it was becoming probably slightly more clear that this really is the needle in a haystack, and we might be coming back empty-handed at the end of our, you know, of our job here. How did that feel?
It's a slow realization over a course of days that what outcome you think you were going to achieve, you're shifting the goalposts on that every couple of days. So, for example, the aircraft was weight limited to approximately 70 ton. And of that, roughly half of that was fuel. About 40% of that weight was fuel. What we were carrying at the start was two life raft kits, which had the capacity to hold approximately 40 or so people. We, on the first flights, were taking life rafts because we genuinely thought there is a reasonable chance that if this aircraft has gone down here and people have survived, whichever way that has gone into the water, we are going to be able to either drop extra life rafts, extra supplies. And what that meant was we couldn't carry as much fuel. So we compromised our fuel load for those first few missions to take these life rafts to stay below the maximum weight of the aircraft. We thought we were going to find survivors. When that kind of hope faded and coming around to the second week, the decision to, you know, stop carrying life rafts and, you know, take a bit of extra fuel, we thought we were looking for debris, and we still thought we were going to do it based on the updates we were getting every day. We went from hoping we could save lives to then hoping that we could find some closure, and then over time you're not really able to do either of those. So it comes down to a pride thing of going, at least I can, you know, look anyone in the eye, whether it's a family member or any of the people that were tasking us, going, my crew 310 squadron, we gave 110% with what we were asked to do. And I put my hand on my heart and say, the areas you asked us to look, there's nothing there, which is all we could really contribute at that time.
It was a sensational sort of news event worldwide, you know, front page around the world, mm-hmm. suddenly becoming yourself and your crew part of this enormous story, which has got worldwide media interest. How did that sit with you?
We were the first aircraft to take off that day, took off at 6 a.m., came back 10 hours later. And as we're landing and taxiing in on the flight line, I look out and I can see hundreds of media, dozens of cameras, and they're watching my aircraft taxi in. My squadron XO walks straight up and he says, Russ, we need you to, you know, tell the media what you found. I just remember saying, sir, we didn't find anything. We went out there, we did what we've been doing the last few days. And he goes, I just need you to give a statement to the media. You're not going to answer any questions. You just need to tell them what you've been doing. I think what you lose sight of is what was literally my day job was of intense interest to the world, and that of what my crew, the entire crew, was doing and the organization was presenting was a capability that was giving people some sense of hope. And what that, you know, you look back and I think I basically told them what the weather was doing and the fact that we were genuinely hopeful that we would find something tomorrow, because we were. And of course the headline is Air Force crews hopeful of finding MH370 tomorrow.
How often does it cross your mind, like, you know, you think back on your things you've done in your life, how often does this bob up in, you know, in your ocean of your thoughts?
It would be, to this point, the greatest moment, like single point in my career that I wish things had a different outcome. Ideally, if we could have found survivors, like, that would have just been, I think, one of the most ultimate survival search and rescue stories in the history of aviation. And unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. But if we'd been able to find debris at the time, I honestly would. I think about that, you know, a couple of times a year about things that I've done in my aviation career. And if we'd been able to find it or be part of that group that found it, I just think some sense of closure to the families in the world would be, it would have been, you know, unbelievably humbling to be able to be a part of that.
Flight Lieutenant Russell Adams speaking with Rob Hodgson. So we now know how the Air Force search was planned, what it was like at sea looking for clues to tell us where the missing flight and the people on board had ended up. But let's take a look at the world's media camped at RAAF Base Pierce. Squadron leader Jess Aldred has a decade's experience under her belt, but remembers very well taking a call as a new public affairs officer to deal with a global news event.
I remember breathing in really deeply and thinking, what have I got myself into? I've spent 3 days in uniform at an air show, and now I'm going to this massive thing where a plane is missing and a lot of people are on it.
Were you aware of how big that story was?
I don't think I was aware of how big that story really was, and the scope and the scale of it, and how we would never see something that really that big again. Because I was so fresh, I thought, right, this is the excitement that I joined the Air Force for. Like, this is what it's going to be. I'll go and like give this a shot. But, you know, surely there's other people going and I can learn from them and it'll be great. So, I think I was pretty clueless on that 6 hour flight to Perth.
So 6 hours passed pretty quickly, and then boots on the ground. What did you see?
Boots on the ground, heels on the ground, because I didn't have any boots yet, because I was so fresh. We drove up to RAF Base Pierce. There was media all outside, all along the roads. There was media moving into the base. I have never seen so many link trucks, so many fleckies, so many, you know, microphones, and just people just trying to find out what was going on at the base. It was gobsmacking to me.
And the interesting thing, of course, is the base became this epicenter of media activity, and yet the real story was 2,500 kilometres west into the sea.
Yeah, it was, but we were the gateway to that at RAF Base Pierce. We were the way that they could find out. That's where the aircraft were coming back in, and they could find out what was happening out there. It's just this huge appetite to know if we'd found them, if we'd found debris. It was just phenomenal to see how many people wanted to know, like how many people in the world wanted to know where this aircraft was.
So what kind of organisations were there camped outside?
Oh, everything. So, we had everything from our own journalists here, all of the commercial networks, and print and radio, and then some that I hadn't seen before, a lot from Southeast Asia, obviously because of the Malaysian Airlines connection. I think that brought a lot of them down. But then we had ones like the BBC and things from over in the UK. You're like, what are they doing in this little backwater in the back of Perth trying to find out about an aircraft that's crashed somewhere out there off Australia, which we thought at the time. It's a long way to come for a news story.
So interestingly, and it doesn't happen a lot at big events like that for the press, the Air Force took the view that it would better have them inside the fence than outside, which was a really good, cool thing to do. Did that help with selling messages, setting things up, making approaches to the media?
Absolutely. So the first thing was very much around safety, right? Like, it was really unsafe for them to be out there. And every time we had cars go in and out, it was also about just making sure that they weren't trying to rush at the gate and things to get interviews from RAF members going in and out. But once we had them in there, we set up a system with a whiteboard, because, you know, there's a lot of bandwidth being used by their equipment, of, you know, background information on aircraft, on regular briefings, on when we would be doing flight line tours, so they could come and get vision of takeoffs and landings, when we would have media interviews with the aircrew. So we really could shape that with them so that we manage their expectations of what we could provide them, and to ensure that their reporting was also accurate with that aircraft fact sheet and things like that.
And you've also got this added complication that it was a broad bunch of media, so not just television, but radio, print, socials, the list goes on.
Yeah, it really was. And trying to make sure that we could feed them in a relevant way the content that they needed was really challenging. And sometimes we were quite restricted in what we could do that day because we only had one wave of flights departing, and they weren't returning until, you know, midnight or 11 p.m. at night, which isn't great for TV news to kind of capture an aircraft landing in the dark. It doesn't tell the story. So that provided some challenges to us in how do we support them. We did do what we call a rack and stack, but we got their media inquiries in. And I think by my second day, that rack and stack of media inquiries asking for specific actions from us was at about 125 different requests of interviews or imagery or flights as well. So that was quite complex to deal with. To meet the needs of theirs and of the 24-hour news cycle.
The other thing you had that was challenging is there was no good news coming out of this. If you were successful as an Air Force in the search, there was no good news.
Yeah, that was the really complicated part, or the hard part of it, I think, is trying to tell the Air Force's and the international partners' story in a way that was still really respectful of the fact that 239 people were lost out there, lost, not missing, and they were unlikely to come back, which meant 239 families were viewing this media output. So making sure that our coverage was respectful of the fact that we were going to be talking about loss at some point.
The epicenter for news, but also the epicenter of almost every VIP in this country, visiting dignitaries, Malaysians, Chinese. How did you cope with that?
The visits were big, but I saw the visits as an opportunity to, one, kind of ease the burden a little bit on us because we didn't really have an answer for have we found it yet for the media. So it gave the media something to cover. And two, I really appreciated that it brought light or retained interest in the search from a number of governments. That was important to keep the search going, and I think we were hopeful still collectively that we'd find the aircraft. So visits are visits and they're busy, but it provided the media something that day when we felt we couldn't always give them something.
So you've done the first few days. You've had your VIPs, you've had your initial hits, the aircraft come and go. That in itself satisfies a global audience for a little bit. They're then wanting more and more and more. The next thing that sort of happened is you were embedding journalists into flights.
We flew with the journalists for media flights. We had a plan in place if we saw debris in the water that we potentially identified as the missing aircraft. But it mostly relied on us building a relationship with those outlets that were on board the aircraft with us and trying to build that trust that they would give us some time before they release that. Because at the end of it all, every media outlet there wanted the exclusive. They wanted that story. And it was complex for us to manage that. It never came about. We didn't find the aircraft. But I kind of was never sure how we were actually going to make that work of please don't go and break the biggest news story in the world. We just need a little bit of calm before you do.
And duty of care to those families who've lost, you know, their loved ones.
Absolutely. And part of it is a duty of care because whilst we might perceive that we'd seen debris of the aircraft, we wouldn't be able to confirm it until it had been properly identified. So, you know, if we saw something, we would come in low. The weather was pretty bad, so we'd come in at like 300 feet above sea state 6 seas and look really closely at it, take imagery of it. And if we thought it was something, we would then have to provide that into the ship, the Navy ships out there, and they would go and collect that debris and it would be assessed. So it was almost trying to demonstrate to them that if you reported something that was just a hunch, maybe that wouldn't be credible reporting and could make the families feel the loss more profoundly if it turned out to not be true.
They then want to know, why have you not found this thing? Isn't it just the easiest thing in the world? Not really understanding the scale of the search, the conditions out there. Did you change a few hearts and minds when they'd sort of spent time in your shoes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they saw that we were searching for the absolute tiniest needle in the world's biggest haystack when they got out there, and that the conditions were really rough, that flying your square, like the air crew were doing, was quite... they've been quite thorough in their search, and then to think of that multiplied out with all of the assets, I think that gave them really good perspective, and it was a really good thing for us to be able to do for them to see that. In saying that, we only had a 3-person team, so every time we had a media flight, we left 2 people back at base to deal with 120 of the world's media, while one person had 2 media on board an aircraft. So it was big for us to be able to manage that, but it was important for the media to see it and gave them extra vision as well to kind of keep the story going.
Ultimately, the real focus of the potential search was about finding the black box and the beacons, which had a 30-day shelf life in their battery, so 40 days as a rough guide. And that was, I think, the driving force to scale back and decide that was enough. How difficult is it to stop that operation when it's so intense?
That was the hardest day of my career. Walking away. We just felt so flat. We worked so hard, and we felt like, as an Air Force and as a combined force, you know, when we work hard, when we have a strategy, when we plan, we can deliver. That's what we do as a military force, and we couldn't.
It's easy to see the impact that it's had on you and probably other people. You can't take part in global events without taking some of that home with you. I wonder now, they're looking 10 years back, whether you still are hopeful that there may be some news sometime?
Yeah, absolutely. I follow every news story that thinks they've found a lead. Every news story.
Thanks to Squadron Leader Jess Aldred, ending our look at the Royal Australian Air Force operation searching for missing Malaysian airline MH370. Thanks too to our other guests, Air Commodore Andrew Craig Heap, Commander of the Multinational Task Group, and Air Force Pilot Flight Lieutenant Russell Adams. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for another episode of In Conversation from the Royal Australian Air Force.